Good morning. Thank you so much for being here, members and visitors alike. We have a fair number of both. We have a number of our members who are out for one reason or another. Keep them in your prayers, of course, as always. It is that time of year, our favorite time of year, when invariably preachers feel compelled to talk about taxes. Everybody's least favorite uncle intervenes in our lives and takes all of our money. And how awful this is. And I'm not a big fan of taxes, I'll be perfectly honest with you. But that's not really the point. The point is that we will typically turn to passages such as Luke chapter 20 and verse 19 and following. We read this a few moments ago. And deal with this in the context of basically the same question that was posed before. Is it proper to give taxes to Caesar? And the traditional position that I've always heard taken from this position by preachers like me, is that yes, you are required to pay taxes because that's what being a good citizen is all about, and because Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's," which I think is true, and I think it's a valid use of the verse. I think it's a valid argument to make if you're having questions about what the Bible teaches with regard to paying taxes. I would encourage you to read this passage a little bit more dutifully. I think that Jesus is relatively straightforward about our responsibility. But, that being said, clearly that's not the main point that Jesus is getting at here in this context. It is in the context of the parable of the vine growers, and this is one of many parables that Jesus told. Verse 19 actually alludes to the earlier parable. And there are many others that indicate Jesus' dissatisfaction, and maybe that's a kind choice of words, with the religious establishment of his day. People who claim, in fact, to have been serving God and wanting to pursue the things of God and looking forward to the Messiah and his kingdom, but in reality, they were very ensconced in their own reality, very comfortable with their own lifestyle. They really didn't have a whole lot of interest in growing. They didn't have a lot of interest in correcting their mistakes, their moral mistakes, or doctrinal mistakes even. And when Jesus pointed such things out, they tended to want to kill him, and eventually they did. And Jesus tells this story in the context of this one who comes from this background, someone who is wanting to disprove Jesus, to discredit Jesus, to render him moot with regard to spiritual matters and political matters. Is it lawful? And of course, the trap here is that if Jesus can somehow be confirmed as a Rome supporter, as someone who is an apologist for these foreign conquerors that have come in, well, he's going to lose popularity that way because people don't like paying taxes. And they certainly don't like paying taxes to Romans. And if he were to stand up in public and say, yes, you have to pay your taxes to Romans, he's going to look like the absolute opposite of every revolutionary they've ever seen or followed after, and he's going to lose some popularity. On the other hand, if he stands up publicly, and that's where he is here, he's in the temple, and maybe even in full view of Roman officials, and says, no, you don't have to pay taxes. Well, then he loses credibility with the Romans, and he gets in trouble with the Romans. And the Romans, they see him as absolutely a revolutionary, and they tend to kill revolutionaries. And actually, that's basically what they did with Jesus too. Both of these groups got their way, if you look at it that way. And Jesus somehow, as he always does, being so much wiser than his accusers, is able to find a pathway that does not accomplish the goals of either of these groups, that does not, in fact, lead him away from the multitudes, that does not lead him away from the Romans, that in fact validates all that God has always said with regard to government, with regard to morality, with regard to submission and authority in such matters. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, and to God the things that are God's. And I think the emphasis, although we typically put it on the first part, and I'm doing it in my sermon title, so I stand accused here as well. The main point is on the second part. The main point is not that there's some kind of question with regard to the Jews of Jesus' day, whether or not it was appropriate to pay taxes to Caesar, whether they should do it, whether they shouldn't do it. That was not the main concern. The main concern was that they were not rendering to God the things that were God's. And that has specific application with regard to their understanding of who Jesus is. And that has a more general application as well with regard to spiritual matters and prioritizing spiritual matters. Jesus is very fond of criticizing the scribes and Pharisees. He has a whole chapter in Matthew chapter 23 criticizing these hypocrites who claim to be serving spiritual things and in fact are not doing any such thing. A fair part of the Sermon on the Mount, the first few verses of Matthew chapter 6, is spent talking about these matters. The Pharisees, they have the truth. Listen to what they say, but do not follow after their example because they are not spiritual examples. What we need to do is learn appreciation for both of these things. Yes, we do need to understand how to properly render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. But we also, in the process, need to understand what it means to render unto God the things that are God's. And that's what we're going to be talking about for a few moments here today. When we say rendering unto Caesar, and it doesn't matter what government you have or what his name is. Caesar, of course, by the time of Jesus, has come to be an all-encompassing term with regard to Roman officials and Roman government at large, Roman emperor in particular. And this, of course, takes the name from Julius Caesar if you go back far enough. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. What Jesus means here is that we have an obligation, a real obligation, to government in this life. Now, if you're like me, that does not fill your heart with joy. But it's real. And it has always been real, in fact, that we have an obligation to submit to government. And that has a few practical applications with regard to that. The obvious one, of course, is that we're supposed to obey laws. The laws that are given to us by government are given as a way of establishing order and decency and protecting the innocent, protecting the minority. This is the role that government is supposed to play, has always played, or supposed to have played, in human society. Paul discusses this, ironically, in the book written to the Romans, people who are right there in the belly of the beast, as it were. Paul says in Romans chapter 13, verse 1, every person is to be subject in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinances of God. And they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. So it's kind of like breaking God's law when you break man's law. That's what he's saying here. And our response to that oftentimes is, well, what if the government is bad? Or what if the law is bad? Well, we don't have a lot of loopholes in this text, do we? Now, if you want to talk about obeying God's law and so doing breaking God's law that you have to choose between one and the other, you choose God first, I'm all for that. But let's be honest about this. We live in the United States of America in the 21st century. That is just not very relevant in our modern day. We do not have to break our civil law to keep God's law. And oftentimes the funding issue comes up. Well, how can I pay taxes to my government when my government's going to use it for nefarious purposes or illegal purposes or immoral purposes for abortion and all kinds of things like that? That's a fair argument. And if Rome had been an absolutely perfect moral government, I might be inclined to agree with you on that. But again, Paul says this and with regard to a tyrannical government, one that had no particular regard for rights, except when it's convenient to have regard for rights. It certainly didn't protect the rights of Christians, didn't uphold the cause of Jesus Christ by any stretch of the imagination. No First Amendment, no Second Amendment, none of these other amendments, no Bill of Rights at large. It's basically whatever the tyrant says. And it is that government, that oppressive, at least oftentimes oppressive, tyrannical government, to which Paul says, you submit to them. So I don't think that the financing argument works very well at all. I have no doubt that Rome used its resources that it drew from Palestine and other places to fund things that were immoral or ungodly or whatever, building idol temples or whatever. I have no doubt of that whatsoever. And yet they were required to submit to obey the laws. When we are willing to submit to these laws, regardless of what they are, regardless of how fair or unfair they happen to be, regardless of how mean or kind our government happens to be, our willingness to submit to law shows our general attitude toward authority at large. There's a certain tendency, especially among young people, where we appreciate the bad boys, where we appreciate the rebels. You know, am I dating myself here? You guys know who James Dean is? The rebel without a cause. This is some kind of valuable thing, to be rebellious just for the sake of being rebellious. That's what young people do, and oftentimes it is what they do. And we can come to see that, especially in our youth, as being an inherently valuable thing. But the Bible does not portray it as an inherently valuable thing. The Bible just calls it rebellion. And the tendency is, and the older you get, sorry to sound like an old guy here, the older you get, the more you appreciate that a rebellious attitude in a particular circumstance tends to translate into a rebellious attitude at large. If you show a lack of regard for parental authority, you wind up mouthing off to your teachers at school, you wind up mouthing off to your boss at work, and eventually mouthing off to the deputy sheriff that pulls you over for speeding, whoever it happens to be. Your attitude with regard to authority in a particular situation tends very strongly to be your overall attitude. Now, what does that have to do with anything? Well, what it has to do with is this. If you have a dismissive attitude, a nonchalant attitude, a rebellious attitude toward civil authority, it is not a great leap to think that you might at some point come to have a rebellious attitude toward God's authority. And regardless of what position you take on civil authority, we cannot have that. And I would like to think that we would all agree on that. That you simply cannot rebel against the will of God in your life. And the best way for us to accept His authority is to practice accepting authority, submitting to authority in all situations. Now the kids are just convinced at this point that I'm going to stick Ephesians 6:1 in here. And this is an opportunity for you to obey your parents in the Lord. And I'm not going to do that. Not really. Anyway, part of obeying laws, of course, is paying tribute. He goes on to talk specifically about this. In verse number 7, render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. A lot of versions have the word tribute here or tax. And there it is right there in black and white. The Apostle Paul, speaking by inspiration, tells us that certain people are authorized by civil government to take our money. And when they are authorized to do so, and then when they ask you for that money, you give them the money. Now, you may not be inclined to do that. Maybe you're one of those people who doesn't mind paying your taxes. I've heard about people like that. I've never met one, but I've heard about people like that. I can't stand paying taxes. And I don't pay any extra if I can avoid it. Brother Eubanks is fond of saying that the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion is 5 years and $50,000. And that's a valid point. I got no problem with avoiding taxes, if you can. But if the law requires you, and breaking that law means evading taxes, that is a violation of our precepts, not just civil law, but also our responsibility toward God. The way that government uses those funds is not our concern. Now, we live in a society where we have the ability to petition our government for redress of grievances. We can have a free speech and free assembly and these sort of things. You have an opportunity to have a say of some sort, at least, in how government uses those funds. And by all means, do that. Exercise your speech. Do that. Nothing wrong with that at all. But until the law changes, you do what the law tells you to do. That's what the text clearly indicates for us to do with regard to civil government, political government. Now, beyond that, if I've convinced you that you need to pay your taxes, that's great. But I want to go a step further than this. There is also an attitude of reverence, an attitude of honor that is owed to government that Paul touches on here in Romans chapter 13. I'm going to refer you to another passage in 1 Peter chapter 2, where it is not just a matter of making sure all our T's get crossed and our I's get dotted. We are to have an attitude of honor, of respect for government. And again, it's not necessarily because government deserves our respect. It's because God asked us to. God told us to. Because these agents, whether they recognize it or not, they almost certainly don't recognize it. But even if they don't, they are agents of God. They are tools in His hand to accomplish His purposes. They may be rejecting that purpose. They may be fighting against that purpose. They may not be accomplishing that purpose at all. But nevertheless, this is the role that is given to them by God, and because they are in that role, we have an obligation to show reverence. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 and following. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people. Love the brotherhood. Fear God. Honor the king. Show a proper reverence toward political officials. Now, this is a difficult kind of thing to apply in a free society such as ours, where the ability to speak out against the government is not only protected, but to a certain degree encouraged. That's what political races and elections and such are all about. I don't think that anyone would try to claim that this verse says you can never say anything negative about an elected official. I hope that's not what it's saying, because I do that. I do that a lot with regard to a lot of elected officials. But is there a way for us to show discontent, for us to show dissatisfaction, to show even anger toward an elected official and still do it with respect, still do it with honor? I would suggest to you it's not all that much different from our relationship with anybody else in the world, any actual humans that we deal with, who are in sin. I hear preachers say this all the time. I say this all the time, that we can love the sinner but hate the sin. We can do that. We can go to an erring sinner and say, you're not doing right, and you need to do right, and bad things are going to happen if you don't, not from me but from God, and to say that in a loving and respectful and kind way. There are other ways of doing it. There's name-calling and mudslinging and deception and all kinds. But you don't have to do that. It may not be taken in the right spirit, but you can say it in the right spirit. You can talk to your friends who are caught up in homosexuality or drug abuse or drunkenness or promiscuity or whatever it happens to be, and be friends with them and be kind to them and be even generous to them and still make your position on their sin known. If we can do that with humans, if we can do that with neighbors, is it not possible to also do that with government? Can we still show respect, show honor to government while we disapprove of government? It's a fine line to walk, and maybe it might not be such a bad idea if we're having trouble with a blurry line there to stay a little bit further away from the jokes about the president or whatever, as opposed to jumping in head first to such things. I don't know. That's going to be your judgment. But let's make sure that we do not become less Christ-like because of our political positions, because of what's going on in the halls of Congress or the White House. That's rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Now, to the main point here, let's talk about this for a little bit. While we are doing this, we need to make sure that we render unto God the things that are God's. There is an obligation that we owe to God that is greater than anything that we owe to government, which is why, when we cannot honor them both, when it has to be one or the other, we choose God instead of government. We see various ones in Bible history, Old Testament especially. Well, I take that back. There are plenty in the New Testament as well. People who are willing and eager, in fact, to embrace the things of God at the expense of their relationship with government. Daniel in the lion's den, of course, in Daniel chapter 6, we know about that. Stephen opposing the religious leaders of his day, getting stoned for it in Acts chapter 7. And others as well. The Apostle Paul looking at King Agrippa and accusing him of sin. At Felix accusing him of sin. We can and we should be doing these things if we are willing and eager to submit to the rule of God. That means, this may start looking a little bit familiar, obeying God's laws. If we obey man's laws, then surely we're under obligation to obey God's laws. Jesus says, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Well, that's pretty straightforward, right? John 14, 15. If we truly are committed to the things of God, if we truly accept Jesus Christ as Lord, what exactly do we think the word Lord means? Yes, I'll call you Lord, Lord, but I'm not going to do the things that you say. Jesus implies that such is going to be the case with some people in Luke 6, verse 46. Exactly what kind of a Lord do you have when you don't do what he tells you to do? The word Lord, of course, has long historical overtones. If you were 500 years ago, 600 years ago, and you were to look at a person that you called Lord and he were to tell you to do something and you wouldn't do it, you'd likely get your hand chopped off or something worse than that. That's what being a Lord is. A Lord means he calls the shots. He makes the rules. And our job as subjects to that Lord is to do what the Lord has told us to do, obeying his laws. Now, we have a blessing in our life when we're submitting to God's rules, when we're submitting to the law of Christ. It's very different than submitting to the United States Constitution or your local magistrates or whatever law may be in question in a particular civil area. Those laws may or may not be good laws. Those laws you may or may not approve of. They may or may not facilitate some greater culture or some greater society in the short term or the long term. But Christ's laws are always good. Jesus has never asked you to do something that was not in your own best interest. At the very least, in your long-term best interest. You may not perceive it as being in your best short-term interest, but I would argue even in your short-term best interest, it's better for you. And certainly in the long term. His commandments are not burdensome, the text says in 1 John chapter 5, verse 3. Jesus is not trying to put some kind of obligation on us to make our lives more miserable or more uncomfortable. He's not trying to afflict us in some way. He's trying to elevate us. He's trying to lift us up. He also asks us to pay tribute. Now, that has financial implications as well, but of course the main tribute that we offer to the Lord is a tribute of praise. I'll refer you back to the Psalms. For instance, and any number of psalms would do here. I'm going to refer you to one of my favorites, Psalm 51, where David here writing in the aftermath of his own sin and the prospect of his own forgiveness. He says in verse 15, O Lord, open my lips that my mouth may declare your praise. For you do not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You're not pleased with burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken heart. A broken and contrite spirit, O God, you will not despise. Now, he doesn't mean by this that God actually did not like burnt offerings and all those burnt offerings that he asked people to do. That was a big, big lie. That's not what David means here. This is a form of the not but phrase that I talk a lot about, where one aspect of the comparison is being diminished for the sake of emphasizing the other aspect. God is not just trying to take our animals, to take our money. That's not what he really wants. What he wants is a broken and contrite heart. He wants you to give your soul to him. He wants you to give it to him willingly and honorably, to pay him the tribute from your heart, the tribute of praise that he is due. Now, that has physical implications. That has implications with regard to animal sacrifices back then, to other offerings that we give today as well. But we are told in various passages, including in particularly 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, that the tribute that we offer to God, including the money that we give to support the work of the Lord's church, that this is a free will offering, that this is something that we do because we love God, because we are committed to God, and to show our commitment to him and to our neighbors and to our family. And the one who sows sparingly is going to reap sparingly. The one who sows bountifully is going to reap bountifully, the text says. You commit yourself to spiritual things. And the more you commit, the more you give to him of your heart, of your soul, of your attention, the more you're going to get from it. Now, I've had various conversations, and I'm sure you probably have too, with people who say, well, I just didn't get anything out of church today. Oh, really? That's unfortunate. Why do you think that was the case? Well, you arrived 10 minutes late. You left during the invitation song. You took 3 water breaks in between. You were distracted, you know, chuckling and passing notes, and how could you have gotten anything out? You didn't put anything into it. If you put something into your life with Christ, you're going to get rewards from it. If you sow bountifully, you will reap bountifully, the text says. Maybe the problem isn't with the church. Maybe the problem isn't with the preacher. Maybe it is, but maybe it's not. Maybe we're just not giving ourselves to the Lord. Maybe we're not getting the tribute that he deserves to him in these situations. And this connects directly, of course, to the idea of reverence. The idea of acknowledging who God is and coming before him with a certain attitude of heart and disposition that that honors and praises him, that shows the gap, the spiritual gap between him and us. Acknowledging that he is so far greater than we are ourselves. Hebrews chapter 12, verse number 28 and following. Therefore, since we receive a kingdom which cannot be shaken, let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable sacrifice with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. There's a couple of different motivations given to us there in that context. There is gratitude. We are grateful for what he has done. And that brings us to his throne, to offer up this acceptable sacrifice, to give him what he asks for, give it to him in the way that he asks for it. But in so doing, also remembering that our God is a consuming fire. And I would like to look at that as a positive kind of thing. That zeal for the Lord has eaten me up like it ate up Jesus in the temple when he was casting out the money changers. There is a sense, I suppose, in which God can consume us in a positive sort of way. I'm not sure that's what Hebrews means here. I think this is probably in a negative sense. And usually spiritual fire is a negative thing in the text. I think it's probably negative here too. Our God is a consuming fire. For those who do not have gratitude, for those who do not show reverence, who come before him flippantly or dismissively, with whatever spare time they might be able to offer, considering somehow that they're blessing God, that they're willing to spend 10 minutes on him this week. Our God is a consuming fire. John the Baptist said this of Jesus back in Matthew chapter 3. Remember that he was going to separate the wheat from the chaff. The wheat was going to be gathered into his garner. Clearly that is the reaping of the righteous. And the chaff is going to be burned with unquenchable fire. That's destruction. That is rejection by God. And even eternal punishment. This is the lack of reverence that we show and the consequences that come with that. Yes, we delight in his fellowship. Yes, we are privileged, and we count ourselves privileged to come before him. We sing with joy in our hearts. We come and we leave with smiles on our faces. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. I hope that you take a great deal of joy, a great deal of satisfaction, and even pleasure out of your association with Christians today. That's a good thing. But let's not forget about the fear. Let's not forget about who God is. Yes, we delight in his fellowship. Yes, we delight to be in his presence. But we at no point forget about the consuming fire. We always remember that there is a considerable gap between him and us. I cringe when I start hearing people using these familiar daddy type terms for the big man upstairs. Remember who God is. And show him the proper reverence. That being said, when this person comes to Jesus and he inquires of him whether it was proper to offer tribute to Caesar, he is in this one short question and in the build up to it, showing an ignorance, and I think probably a willing ignorance, of both of these concepts. Not showing respect to Caesar as he should, not showing respect to God as he should. And I think that we can also fall victim to the same kind of attitude. We should not be looking for opportunities to break the law. As I was preparing this lesson, I was putting myself in Red English's shoes and Taylor Bethea's shoes. Way back in the day, 24 years ago almost, 23 years ago, we were thinking about having this baby of ours and how it was going to come out. And I had this nifty idea. Wouldn't it be great? And I guarantee you, every husband in this house has done this. Wouldn't it be great if the time came? You know, honey, I think it's time to go. You just don't go. You know, maybe just wait a little bit. You know, it's just pace ourselves for an hour, a couple hours, 6 hours, 8 hours, whatever, until it gets really desperate, until it becomes obvious we just got to get to the hospital. And then we get in the car and we go as fast as we can, right? Because now we got an excuse, right? I can go 90 miles an hour down highway, Highway 9 or whatever. Sure, why not? This is an excuse. In fact, I'd probably get a police escort. I bet you I wouldn't get a ticket for that. They'd let me off for that. I got a good excuse. I got a pregnant woman in the house. I got a pregnant woman in the car. I never shared this plan with Tracy. Never executed this plan. Didn't really get past the formative stages in the whiteboard process. It struck me pretty early on this was a bad idea on multiple fronts. And this is one of the fronts. And it's just not appropriate for us to try to set ourselves up where it's okay to break the law. That very concept shows a lack of regard for government, a lack of regard for law as a whole. We need to be servants of government, not rebels against government. We are the ones who are asked to go a mile, we go two instead. We go the extra mile, literally and figuratively, in allowing government to rule our lives. I'm not suggesting if Uncle Sam asks you for $1,000, you give him $2,000 and that makes you a better Christian. I'm not saying that. I'm not suggesting you do that. I'm certainly not going to do that. But regardless of how you try to apply this, make sure that you are not putting yourself in a position where you are showing contempt for government rather than showing honor to government. And of course, the same thing goes for Jesus' authority. If we can have proper regard for civil authority, surely we can find it in our hearts to have a proper regard for Jesus' authority. The entire reason this conversation happens in Luke's account, the entire reason that we have this conversation in the first place is because people don't want to honor Jesus. They have made up in their mind already who Jesus is or who he is not, and they have dismissed him, they've disregarded him. They're looking for opportunities now to reject his will, to not go in his direction. And there are all kinds of applications that we could talk about here that we could spend hours on any of these and we're not going to. But the law of marriage, for instance. Do we care or do we not care about what Jesus says with regard to marriage? He says, what God's joined together, let not man separate. He says, the one who joins himself to a one who is inappropriately divorced and remarries commits adultery. And again, we could talk for hours exactly what that means. But let's accept, at least in principle, we're going to do what Jesus says. And if it's not especially what we want to hear, well, that wasn't what the apostles wanted to hear either. It'd be better not to marry if we're going to have to submit to a law like that. And he says, you know what? Some people are not going to be able to do this. But if you are willing to make yourselves committed to the Lord, if you are willing to give yourselves completely, then you will find a way to do it. You will find a way, even if you have to be made a figurative eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake. Law of service. Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 through 5. There are Christians who do not do anything for other people. I don't understand how you can do that in the context of what the New Testament talks about. The New Testament is very, very clear about this. That we are to serve others, not just serve ourselves. It doesn't matter how healthy or sick you are. It doesn't matter how rich or poor you are. It doesn't matter how young or old you are. If you are not serving somebody else, you're not submitting to Jesus. That's what the text says. Do nothing, he says in verse 3, from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus. And he goes on to explain how it is that Jesus showed this attitude of submission, and how we ourselves also are required to do the same thing, to think about other people's problems, other people's needs, other people's wishes and desires, not just our own. Any four-year-old can be selfish. Every four-year-old is selfish. No offense to the four-year-olds in the house. We are grown in Jesus. And we owe our brethren, we owe our society better than that. It is our obligation to serve him. Now, you can make up some kind of excuse if you want to. And any number of excuses are available. Lots of them are being used these days. Maybe you're using one or two of them. But submitting to the authority of Jesus, running unto God the things that are God's, means finding a way to accomplish his purposes rather than looking for loopholes. We need to find a way to make this happen. The law of baptism. And we'll close with this one. Jesus said, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved. Now, not everybody's going to agree that the Bible actually means what it says there. And if you You know, look in my library and look at the various commentaries that have written there by very intelligent people, very learned people. Some of them are going to go to great extremes to try to explain why you do not, in fact, need to be baptized in order to be saved. And with all due respect to such ones in their scholarship, they're just not submitting to the authority of Jesus Christ. Jesus said, this is your rule. And if you're going to accept my rule, then you have to accept baptism. Jesus himself needed to do it to fulfill all righteousness, he told John the Baptist. Surely if Jesus felt compelled to be baptized, I can't find a loophole to excuse myself. That means I must do what he has told me to do. I must do what those faithful ones who acted and lived in faith did and told other people to do. And that touches the hearts of certain ones here in the room this morning who have not yet been baptized. If you're considering yourself rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's because you have not, you know, robbed a bank or shot somebody or thrown a rock at somebody's head, then good. God bless you for that. Please do not grow weary in well-doing. Keep going with that. But render to God the things that are God's too. And if you haven't begun even this at this very initial stage by accepting him as Savior, by putting him on in baptism simply because he told you to do it, then what does that say toward your general attitude toward the things of God? If you want to live your life in faith, if you want to live your life in obedience, then start here. Start by accepting Jesus Christ as your Savior, putting him on in baptism, acknowledging him with your deeds and with your words as the Son of God, as the Savior of the world. And have your sins washed away in baptism, not because of some power of water, but because of the power of Jesus Christ, because of the power of the blood that was shed on your behalf and on my behalf. If we can help you be right with God today, if we can help you draw closer to your Lord, if we can help you into the water of baptism, if in any way we can help you walk with Christ more perfectly, more completely, we urge you to respond to the Lord's invitation that's extended for you at this time. While we stand and sing at this time, would you come?